Balls.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Before he joined the Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke was a university professor and an expert on the Great Depression. As chair at the Fed, Bernanke faced the second worst economic crisis in U.S. history. He was determined not to repeat what he believed were mistakes of the past. A new book illuminates how Bernanke and his team used and perhaps stretched the power of the Fed during a critical time in U.S. history. The book is titled In Fed We Trust, and author David Wessel joins me in the studio. He is a Pulitzer Prize-winning financial reporter. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Diane.
Good to see you.
Good to see you.
I must say, you've been doing an awful lot of reporting on what's been happening in the last few months. Do you believe we are near the end?
I believe that we have pulled back from the abyss, that the chances of falling into another Great Depression were shockingly high last fall, and that chapter is over. It appears that the economy is beginning to heal, and I expect that people will determine later, the people who determine these things, that the recession is ending about now or will end soon. But I don't think that people in general understand how painful the recovery is likely to be, and how long we're going to have to put up with the side effects of this crisis, high unemployment and so forth.
You perhaps heard the last conversation with Senator Barbara Boxer of California, who, how can I put this, put a great deal of responsibility on Alan Greenspan's shoulder for not having acted more forcefully regarding the skyrocketing housing bubble.
I think that the first thing one has to say is that the list of people and institutions who failed is very long. The banks, the sophisticated investors, the mortgage brokers, the credit rating agencies, the people who took mortgages they couldn't afford, the financial press that yelled in some cases, but not loudly enough to make a difference, and so on. But the Fed, and Alan Greenspan was in charge, does have to take some responsibility. As I point out in the book, after the fact, with hindsight, people say he kept interest rates too low, too long, and that fueled a lot of borrowing and speculation. And I think that's probably right, but only in hindsight. Where I think Mr. Greenspan is might have acted differently, even knowing what he knew at the time, is in using the Fed's regulatory muscle to try and curtail some of the abuses in mortgages, the lending to people.
And what are you saying he could have done?
He could. There was a lot of things he could not have done. He didn't control the entire regulatory system of the government, but the Fed did have powers under something called the Homeownership Equity Protection Act to set rules on subprime mortgages, which they have since done. And they did a little bit, but they didn't do very much. He didn't use his enormous influence as a public speaker to warn against this very much. And he could have, for instance, asked Congress to do more, asked the president to do more, or lectured the banks. He says in retrospect, I think there are two things, the reason for that. One is he said he honestly didn't realize how bad the subprime thing was. And when he first saw the numbers from a trade magazine, he didn't believe them. And so it just happened much faster, the boom in subprime, than he had anticipated. That's an error of judgment and fact. But I think the second thing is that Chairman Greenspan really was suspicious that regulation could do things A lot of people, a lot of Democrats in particular, have a lot of faith in regulators. And he said, well, look, there's a lot of sophisticated people playing poker at this table. They have a lot of money in the game. Surely they'll keep the table honest. And it turned out that was not true. And he's admitted that much, that his worldview was just wrong on that.
David Wessel, his new book is titled In Fed, We Trust, Ben Bernanke's War on the Great Panic. Do join us, 800-433-8850. I want to take you back before we talk about 2007 and 2008. I want to take you back to when the walls came down within the banking and financial institutions and how that affected the place we are now.
Well, you're absolutely right. There was, after the Depression, a decision by the Congress to put a wall between conventional banking, the taking of deposits and the making of conventional loans, and the deposits are insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. That was on one side of the wall. And investment banking, which is the business of underwriting securities and placing bets in financial markets, was on the other side. The wall came down very gradually, brick by brick, and in the And because
beginning when?
Well, it began early in the 90s. It had to do with the way business was changing and people were finding ways around Depression era laws. And then, of course, in the end, Greenspan's applause, Congress repealed the law altogether. Now, I think there is a debate about how significant that change was. We know that it did mix investment banking and regular banking and allowed some banks to take a lot of risks that they might not have been able to take under a different regime. But we also know that some of the institutions that got into the biggest trouble, like Bear Stearns, like AIG, and like Lehman Brothers, were really unaffected by the change in this law. They were never part of the core banking system. They had very few insured deposits. So I think people are looking for, if only we hadn't passed that law, we wouldn't have had a crisis. I think it reflected an attitude that we should let the market do what it wants to do, and we'll be better off in the long run than if we regulate it. But I think people assign a little bit too much blame to the repeal of that statute.
And now do you see going forward a reinstitution of at least some of those regulations rather than relying on the institutions themselves to stay honest?
I don't think we'll re-erect the wall between investment and conventional banking. I think that's the world has moved on for that, and there's too many big global players that mix those businesses, and the businesses aren't as distinct as they were in the 1930s. But I do think we're in an era where world governments, ours included, will be reimposing regulations and looking for ways to prevent the people who drive the financial motor cars on the highway from running the car off the cliff and taking the rest of the economy with it.
And how significant do those regulations have to be to ensure that that doesn't happen?
I don't think there are any regulations and laws that will prevent us from having crises or euphoria and panics. I think the goal of the new regulations and laws ought to be to make it much harder for one bank or one group of banks to get into such trouble that they put the whole economy at risk. It means trying to prevent them from doing that where you can, for making sure they have enough capital so when they get into trouble, they can absorb the blows, and from building some insulation from the rest of the economy. But, you know, it's very interesting. The president and the Treasury Secretary have proposed some new regulations. Some people criticize them for not doing enough, yet they're having trouble getting even their plan through the Congress. It's amazing to me that the memory of the crisis has already begun to fade, and now we're seeing a lot of resistance because a lot of individual players in the financial industry would like to keep their little piece of it safe from government intervention.
And you've got some sort of competition going on between Treasury Secretary Geithner and Fed Chair Bernanke. What's going on there?
Right. Well, there's a lot of tension among the regulators. I suspect there's less tension between Geithner and Bernanke than with some of the others. I think basically Geithner and Bernanke have a pretty close agreement on most things. Where they're having some at least public disagreement is that Geithner and the administration has argued that we ought to have one consumer regulatory agency, and that agency ought to be responsible for protecting consumers from financial problems across the board.
A separate agency. Okay.
And Bernanke is saying, oh gosh, we'd really like to keep this little piece of it in our shop, and we haven't done such a bad job at that, at least since I arrived on the job. But frankly, I don't think that that's Bernanke's priority. And I think that if the Congress decided to make an independent agency, he wouldn't do much screaming and yelling.
You said at the start that we may have moved back from the precipice. There are others who say we could fall into a second round.
I think we could have a very bumpy recovery. I think we could discover that the euphoria of today, you know, the markets have been up and the cash for clunkers is provoking all these sales of cars. And that's leading people to think that, oh, my God, the economic sun is shining again and everything's going to be wonderful. I think that's naive. I think we're going to have a very rough road for a couple of years. But I don't think that the chances of something like last fall, an economic cataclysm that threatened to bring down the entire financial system and push us into something like the Great Depression again with 25% unemployment, I think that's unlikely. And I think in part we have Ben Bernanke and Hank Paulson and others to thank for that.
How long is the unemployment cycle likely to continue to be an upward movement?
Well, it depends how fast the economy grows, but the recent forecast suggests we could have 10% unemployment for another 18 months or so. And there are two reasons for that. One is there's the traditional problem that the economy gets better and businesses are a little reluctant to rehire. But also, businesses seem to be acting unusually this time. They're being much tougher on unemployment than they usually are, given the depth of this recession. And so a lot depends on the attitude of employers. If they think things are going to get better, maybe they'll hire back quickly and we'll be lucky to see the unemployment rate fall. But that's not my best guess right now.
David Wessel, he's economics editor of the Wall Street Journal. He writes the Capital column. That's a weekly outlook on the forces shaping living standards. His new book is titled In Fed We Trust, Ben Bernanke's War on the Great Panic. Hi, it's Diane Rehm, inviting you to take part in an online chat Wednesday afternoon at 1. We'll talk about the news of the day and take your questions. Go to conversation.wamu.org. Become part of our growing community of public radio fans.
Coming up Monday on the Kojo Nandi Show, getting elected leaders to work for you, making yourself heard in the age of too many form letters and so-called astroturf campaigns. Plus, it's human trafficking happening in our own backyard. Meet a survivor and hear how our region's law enforcement and others are helping minors caught up in the local sex trade. The Kojo Nandi Show, noon till 2 Monday on WAMU 88.5.
This broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
And for those of you who've just joined us, David Wessel of the Wall Street Journal is with me. He's their economics editor, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, and the author of a new book titled In Fed We Trust, Ben Bernanke's War on the Great Panic, and a further subtitle, How the Federal Reserve Became the Fourth Branch of Government. Explain that second subtitle.
When the financial crisis hit in late 2007 and early 2008, there was no arm of the government, not the president, not the treasury, not the Federal Deposit Insurance Company, nor the Securities and Exchange Commission, that had the power to fire the money that was needed to prevent us from collapsing. The system we have developed gave only one institution, the Federal Reserve, the power to print money in an emergency and lend it readily to stop a crisis. And so one of the reasons why the Fed is getting so much attention and in fact so much criticism now is that people didn't realize how much power they had. You know, there was a great moment where Barney Frank, the head of the House Financial Services Committee, says to Ben Bernanke, where did you get $85 billion to bail out AIG? And Ben Bernanke says, well, actually, I have $800 billion. And Barney Frank says, wow, nobody in a democracy, no one man in a democracy should have the power to spend $85 billion. So I think that in one sense, there was no choice. The Fed was the only option. But it did expose a kind of, or not a kind of, it did expose a weakness in our system that the President of the United States can fire nuclear missiles without getting anybody's permission. But under our system of government, he can't spend $85 billion to bail out a financial institution, even if he thinks it's essential.
Here's an email from Tom who says, please explain how one day the U.S. government did not have legal authority to rescue Lehman, but a few days later was able to prop up AIG. One cannot get a straight answer on this. What was the role of the U.K.? government in barring a sale of Lehman to Barclays?
It's an excellent question, and I think it is the most maddening one of this whole episode because it's hard to get a clear answer. So going into Lehman weekend in September 2008, Ben Bernanke, Tim Geithner, who was then president of the New York Fed, and Hank Paulson, who was then the Secretary of the Treasury, had hoped to sell Lehman to Barclays, the British bank, just as a few months earlier they had sold Bear Stearns to J.P. Morgan Chase. And if they had to throw some taxpayer money or Fed money on the table, they would have done that. At the last minute, Barclays couldn't proceed with the deal because the British government wouldn't waive a kind of technical rule. And the British government, the British regulators, didn't believe that this was a good deal for Barclays or a good deal for Britain, and they basically stopped it. And from their narrow point of view, they might have been right. Later, after Lehman went bankrupt, Barclays bought the assets they wanted at a much lower price. But Bernanke, Geithner, and Paulson did not come to that weekend with a good plan B. They did not have a way, they did not say to themselves, if Barclays doesn't go through, what can we do to save Lehman so it doesn't have to go to bankruptcy? At the time, Bernanke and Paulson both said, you know, everybody knows that Lehman's in trouble, and they sort of suggested that maybe it would be a good idea for the markets to know that firms can fail. Lehman goes into bankruptcy. The economy is already very weak, but the financial market repercussions of Lehman's bankruptcy are enormous, much greater than they had anticipated. And over time, their story changes a little bit. They say that we didn't have the legal authority to bail out Lehman Brothers because the law says the Fed can lend to somebody, but that person has to have collateral or security. And Lehman was in such bad shape that they didn't have any collateral to lend. To offer to the Fed as security for a loan. In fact, their name wasn't even worth anything. No one was even willing to buy that. So then, the listener is exactly right. So then AIG is about to topple, and they save them. And I think that that shows a couple things. One is, it's easy for them to argue the legal technicality, well, AIG had collateral.
When they need it.
Right. But I think what really happened was, at that moment, they said, wow, we have to do whatever it takes to save the system. And they did find ways to stretch the law that they will never tell us. Did they wish they had done that at Lehman? They're
exactly
sticking to their story that they couldn't.
Yeah, that's the question. If they had saved Lehman.
So there is one of those wonderful what-if questions that we can all have opinions on. So one view is, if they had saved Lehman, things would have been bad, but not awful, and we would be in a better place. The other argument is, if it hadn't been Lehman that pulled down the house of cards, it would have been AIG or somebody else, that the whole structure was imploding and the proximate cause is Lehman. And I think there's actually something to both points of view, but it's very hard to argue that, knowing everything we know now, that Lehman was well handled. And I don't think anybody can make that argument.
And now, remind us of some of the key events since 2007 that really led up to that full-blown crisis in 2008.
In 2007, in August 2007, really just 2 years ago now, is when the housing crisis passed into the banking system, and banks began to have trouble, including some European banks. And things bumped along for about 6 months. And in the beginning of January 2008, Ben Bernanke realizes the economy is a lot worse than he thinks. And in a very dramatic moment, on Martin Luther King Day 2008, he calls together his officials at the Fed, and they do an emergency rate cut of 0.75 percentage point, and they follow that up with 0.75 percentage point a few weeks later, the most dramatic cut in interest rates we've ever seen from the Fed. And they take a deep breath, and they said, finally, we've gotten ahead of this mess. And they're wrong, because in March 2008, Bear Stearns gets into trouble. And Bear Stearns is interesting because Bear Stearns is not a bank. They don't have regular deposits, but they depend on borrowing money short term from other entities. And they discover that no one will lend the money and that people won't even take what's usually safe collateral as money. And they come to the Fed on bended knee and say, we're going to go under unless you save us. And that at that point, the Fed and the Treasury try to sell it to J.P. Morgan Chase. Actually, they tried to sell it to Barclays, too. And in the end, J.P. Morgan Chase says, we'll take it, but you got to take some of their stuff. And the Fed spends $30 billion to basically subsidize the purchase of Bear Stearns to J.P. Morgan Chase. And that establishes for everybody that the Fed is willing to break the rules that it has lived by for 60 years and intervene in the markets to save a failing firm that it had not been responsible for.
You said earlier that there's a long list of reasons that all of this happened, a long list of characters. What about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac? Just how much blame do they deserve?
They deserve some blame, and the government, the Congress, the administration, the regulators deserves some blame for letting them do what they did. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have always been peculiar entities that were on one hand supposed to make money for their shareholders and at the other hand supposed to provide a lot of housing for America. And they did this because they had special privileges that no other financial institution had, and they spent a lot of money on lobbying to make sure that they did not lose those privileges. And they got bigger and bigger, and Alan Greenspan warned about them. Larry Summers, when he was at the Treasury in the Clinton years, warned about them. And basically nothing was done to rein them in. They actually were on the sidelines at the beginning of the subprime thing, and they got in at the wrong time, late. They got into subprime late in the game and lost a lot of money.
Did they get in or were they pushed in?
I don't think they were pushed in. I think that they saw people in the subprime market making a lot of money. And they didn't get in at first, and then they were saying to themselves, well, we're in the business of making money here. We have shareholders. And so they jumped in with both feet just as the bubble is bursting.
Weren't there members of Congress urging that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac loan out more money?
Yes. There were lots of people in Congress, many of them Democrats, but not all of them, who urged Fannie and Freddie to make more and more loans because we were trying to realize what had become a stated policy of our government, that everybody should own a house, even if they couldn't afford it. And so I think the Republicans sometimes like to blame the whole problem on Fannie and Freddie because it's easy. It makes it seem like the Democrats created this, and they did play a role here. There's no doubt about it. But I think one of the interesting things is it turns out that one of the crises that didn't happen is the Fannie and Freddie crisis, because Hank Paulson, with some help from Ben Bernanke, managed to go to Congress. They get the power to basically nationalize Fannie and Freddie before they blow up and cause a problem. And I think that was one of the things that gave them false confidence going into Lehman. This Fannie and Freddie thing, they'd avoided the big catastrophe. So they think, oh, we can do this. And they misjudge their ability to control events.
Speaking of Ben Bernanke, what is he now saying about concerns regarding inflation?
He says that the Fed's job is to prevent inflation from taking off. He says that inflation is not a problem today, that prices are in some cases coming down, not going up. And so he thinks that people who are worried about inflation today are crazy, but although I don't think he uses that word. And he promises to do what's necessary to raise rates and to withdraw credit before inflation takes off. But I think that one of the reasons why people are very suspicious of this vow is that it's not so much a technical problem. The Fed has the weaponry to control inflation if it chooses to do so. But it's not clear that the Fed has the political will to cut off the credit before the economy gets healthy, especially given how much political pressure they are under.
But what about these new Treasury bonds that are being offered that are inflation protected that the Chinese had said they were interested in?
Well, the Treasury has been offering inflation-protected bonds since 1997. It was actually something that economists and bond traders had long thought was a good idea, and Larry Summers, when he was at the Treasury, finally convinced them to offer. I think they make a lot of sense for two reasons. One reason is they can be very good for some investors. If you want to have a safe investment and you want to be sure that you don't get killed by inflation, they offer you a guarantee that no other financial institution can offer.
Give me a specific example.
Well, a lot of there may be an insurance company that has promised to make payments in the future of so much money adjusted for inflation. How do they protect themselves against prices going up very rapidly? They buy these Treasury bonds. Individual investors who say, you know, one of the things I learned in the last few months is that buying stocks and buying houses and putting all your apples in those baskets is a little risky. So I'd like to buy something that's a little safer. But if I buy a regular government bond and we have a lot of inflation, the value of that bond will go down. But if I buy one of these inflation-protected bonds, and they actually sell inflation-protected treasury savings bonds as well, I have some protection against inflation. I think what's behind your question is some people think, well, does that mean that the government is expecting inflation? And I think not. I think that the government is saying there's a market for these securities. The government, U.S. government, is borrowing lots of money, and it has to think about what its customers want. And if customers want to buy inflation protection, then the government can get a good deal on that.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We've got lots of callers. Let's go to Adam in Athens, Ohio. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Diane. Love the show.
Thank you.
I recently read an article about a bill introduced in the House, I believe it's H.R. 1207, by Representative Ron Paul that would grant Congress the authority to audit the Federal Reserve. I was perplexed to find out that Congress didn't have that authority. So I did a little research, and I came to find out, if I understand things correctly, that the Federal Reserve is actually a for-profit private bank, and that they have stockholders around the world that, as far as I can see, make profits off of our taxes, which I find to be outrageous. So my first question is, what do you think about Ron Paul's bill? Do you think that the Fed should be shielded from congressional audit? And if you could describe a little bit, you know, does the Fed make profits off our taxes, or, you know, what's going on with that? And then I had a little quote if I could read after you respond.
Okay. Well, first of all, the Federal Reserve was created by Congress in 1913, and it consists of the Federal Reserve Board in Washington, which is a government entity, and 12 regional Fed banks, which are, as you say, owned by the commercial banks in their districts. That's the way it's set up. The Fed does make a profit, but it turns over those profits to the Treasury. There's no one getting rich off the Federal Reserve trading in securities. The current law gives the Congress and the Government Accountability Office, the auditing arm of Congress, the power to audit the Fed in many of its functions, including the money it lent to Bear Stearns and the bank regulation it does. But it shields one part of the Fed from the audit, and that's the very important part of setting interest rates and deciding whether to expand credit or contract credit. And the argument there is that economies work better, the theory goes, when there's an independent agency that can control inflation, because politicians tend to prefer to do things now that create inflation in the future. And so what the Ron Paul bill, which, as you point out, is not only been introduced in the House, but has more than half the House as co-sponsors, would say, in addition to auditing all the other things at the Fed, which the GAO already does, the GAO would be able to essentially go in and second-guess their policy on interest rates. And Bernanke has said that's a bad idea.
I hope that answers your questions,
Adam.
Sure.
In my research, I thought this was interesting. It seems like the founders of this country were vehemently opposed to a central bank mechanism. And I found an interesting quote from Thomas Jefferson. I'm kind of paraphrasing. I'm going from memory. But it was something to the effect of, he said, "I believe that banking institutions are more dangerous to the liberties of the people than a standing army. And if the bank has the power to create the currency, the corporations that will grow up around them will deprive the people of their property until they wake up homeless on the continent their forefathers conquered." So I'm just curious, you know, what do you think about our founders' views on central banking?
All right.
There was a fantastic debate between Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson on just this question. And Alexander Hamilton believed in a central bank and helped create the first bank of the United States, and Jefferson was against it. So the founders were not agreed on that. And I quote a historian in the book saying that Americans like to quote Jefferson, but they actually live more by Hamilton.
That really is just wonderful. Adam, thanks for your call and for that pretty good from memory quote. David Wessel of the Wall Street Journal is with me. His new book, In Fed We Trust, Ben Bernanke's War on the Great Panic. We'll take more of your calls, your email, when we come back. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. By the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And by the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
WAMU 88.5's Diane Rehm will host a cruise on the Nile River this fall from October 27th to November 10th. The voyage begins in Cairo, then follows the path of the Nile deep into Upper Egypt in cabins with a river view. An Egyptologist will discuss hieroglyphics, mummies, and the pyramids. And guided tours include the Egyptian Museum and Roman ruins in Alexandria. More information is at WAMU.org.
Good morning. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show on WAMU 88.5. Coming up at 11, it's Prairie Home Companion. Tonight at 6 on WAMU 88.5, we present Are We Alone? Grave Matters. We could choose not to pay income tax and suffer the consequences, but we can't avoid death. We'll meet one creature that is biologically immortal, plus a doctor's fight against the world's deadliest disease. That's Are We Alone? Grave Matters, tonight at 6 on WAMU 88.5. 84 degrees in Northwest Washington at 10:39.
This broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
And a caller from Exeter, New Hampshire. Steve, you've got a question for David Wessel.
For David about what the government, meaning the Treasury and the Federal Reserve, actually knew last year about the interconnectedness of the financial system. And let me make that specific. Bear Stearns owed about $33 billion, which they wouldn't have paid, obviously, if they'd gone bankrupt. And now that $33 billion can never grow as a matter of simple arithmetic. And so the more interconnected, the more people they owed that. Too, it seems to me, the more it would dissipate and have the less the impact on any individual other institution. But my question for him is what the government actually knew about who owed what to whom. For example, the government apparently didn't know that the money owed to Goldman Sachs by AIG, which was about $13 billion, was fully hedged, even though Goldman later said it was fully hedged. And so the government paid that off at 100 cents on the dollar. Could you ask him about those specific details?
You just have. Right. Go ahead, Dave.
Those are excellent questions. And the short answer is they knew some, but they didn't know enough. And one of the reasons why they made the decisions that they did in their account is because of these interconnections, they thought that the ripple effects would be enormous. So let's take these one at a time. At Lehman Brothers, they didn't fully appreciate how global Lehman's tentacles were and how screwy the system of putting a firm into bankruptcy are when it has operations all around the world, particularly in the UK. So one of the reasons Lehman made such a big splash was its brokerage arm in London went into bankruptcy immediately, and there was all sorts of fights about who was holding the money and stuff like that. At AIG, they knew something, but they didn't know nearly enough. But I think that they looked at the number of people who had placed bets with AIG and who had bought insurance with AIG and said, if AIG goes down, remember, it's Tuesday afternoon, we got to decide in the next 45 minutes, are we going to let them go or are we going to save them, that they will pull down so many institutions that it will be unsafe. But one of the things that both Paulson and Bernanke have said, and they said repeatedly, is they don't like the choices they had at the time. They would have liked to be able to take over the institution the way the FDIC can take over a bank and decide who gets paid and who doesn't.
And why couldn't they?
The law didn't permit it. The law provides that for banks, not for non-bank financial institutions. The president and the Congress, the president, both Bush and Obama, have proposed new laws that would allow them to do that. The laws haven't yet passed.
Hope that answers it. Steve, thanks for a good question. Here's another one, this one from Daniel, who says, even if it did save us from a catastrophe, do you think it was acceptable that the Fed has the power to print trillions of dollars out of thin air into the economy with no oversight? They make secret agreements with foreign banks and governments. They've refused to tell Congress who is getting the money or to give details of what deals are being made. I say audit the Fed. That's what Danny says.
Right. So I think that we know why we have central banks, and we know that central banks have for hundreds of years had this power of called the lender of last resort, where when you have financial institutions that are sound, but the depositors want the money faster than the bank can get its loans paid off, that the central bank steps in to lend the money so we don't have a financial implosion like we did in the Great Depression. I think that makes a lot of sense, and history suggests to us that without that, we have a worse time. Where the Fed stepped over the line is where they actually invested their money and by proxy the taxpayers' money, to buy stuff from Bear Stearns and to invest in AIG and stuff. And that really was a change. And I think there's a very good question about whether that authority should be invested in a body that is not accountable to Congress. It's interesting to note that that authority, which was created in the Depression, which gives the Fed the right to lend to almost anybody in, quote, unusual and exigent circumstances, does not require anybody else's permission. But in the legislation that President Obama and Tim Geithner have proposed, the Treasury Secretary would have to sign off on those decisions in the future.
I see. I want to ask you about a woman who sounded the alarm a long, long time ago, and nobody paid attention, Sheila Bair.
Right. Sheila Bair is a fascinating a character in this episode, and she appears in cameo roles in the book, but I think there's probably a lot more to learn about what she did and said. So she was very outspoken about some of the risks going on in the housing business, and she was more willing than her colleagues in the Bush administration to push consumer protection, to discipline banks, and to bail out homeowners who were in danger of foreclosure. During the crisis, though, it's interesting. Her role is kind of she gets a mixed review because she took a very distinct view about what her job was. And her job was to do things that protected the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation fund. And that definitely is her job description. But when Bernanke and Paulson say, we got to break some rules here, we got to do whatever it takes, or we're going to have Depression 2.0, she resists. And so there's a lot of tension between her and Bernanke and Paulson and with Tim Geithner as well over the nature of the rescue. And so I think that there are a number of people whose warnings we should have heeded. And she would definitely be in that category. But I think her role during the rescue is somewhat more complicated than the conventional wisdom has it.
All right. Let's go to Dallas, Texas. Good morning, Wayne. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I would like Mr. Russell's comments on how we might find some way to maybe build a firewall between Treasury and the Fed, and possible conflicts of interest, such as the situation that was in New York about a month or so ago with the Fed chair having to resign, and Mr. Paulson's background with Goldman Sachs and handing over billions to Goldman Sachs.
All right, sir. And by the way, David's last name is Wessel. Go right ahead.
I've been called worse things. The caller really asks two very good questions. The first one is the law provides that each of the 12 Federal Reserve banks has a 9-member board of directors. And 6 of those 9 members are chosen not by any public entity, but are chosen by the local commercial banks. 3 of them are bankers and 3 of them are not. It was a political compromise at the time. Some people wanted a private central bank. Some people wanted a government central bank. It does not seem to fit with our normal modern ideas of accountability. It's the kind of thing that when Indonesia did it, the Treasury criticized them for crony capitalism. And it became extremely embarrassing, as the caller points out, that the chairman of the board of the New York Federal Reserve Bank was a guy who had previously been at Goldman Sachs, Steve Friedman. At the time he took the job, Goldman Sachs was not legally organized as a bank. Goldman Sachs becomes a bank, so he's got this kind of awkwardness to begin with, and he's buying and selling, or mostly buying, shares in Goldman Sachs while sitting on the board of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. Now, in fact, these bank boards don't have a hell of a lot of power, but they do get to pick the president of the bank, and they do have some influence. And I suspect that when the dust clears, that system will be changed, and the bankers won't be having so much say. But the second question is sort of, does Goldman Sachs have an unfair advantage? And because so many people from Goldman Sachs have gone into government, they're sometimes called government Sachs. And one of them was Bob Rubin in the last administration, in the Clinton administration, and one of them was Hank Paulson in the Bush administration. And I think that they are card-carrying capitalists, and they come from the Wall Street establishment. But I haven't seen any evidence that they have done things specifically because they benefit Goldman Sachs, although the fact that an institution as mighty as Goldman Sachs was teetering was definitely shook Hank Paulson up and led him to go to Congress and said, okay, the Fed can't do this alone. You've got to give me some money.
Thanks for calling, Wayne. Now, that leads me to the fallout from what we have seen in the last 18 months or so. Do you believe that what might come out of this could be a reshaping of our thinking about capitalism generally?
Yes, I do. I think that for a long period of time, going back to Ronald Reagan, the notion that the more we could let the market do things, the better off we were, was the prevailing wisdom. And we argued about the margins, but basically we were slowly deregulating the American economy, and particularly the financial system. And we convinced ourselves that all this financial innovation was making some people rich and making the economy stronger. And now we know it was making some people rich and basically led the economy to near collapse. So I think it'll be a decade of trying to reconstruct a financial regulatory and other architecture that prevents the market from being quite so taking so many risks with the rest of us. I also think that finance was a bubble too, and too much of our economy was devoted to trading pieces of paper that represented value that other people were creating. And finance is socially essential. We couldn't have houses or life insurance or plan for the future without finance, but finance got a little out of hand, and I suspect we'll see a smaller financial sector. And maybe one good thing about that is that fewer people will go into designing derivatives and more of them will go find cures for cancer or better software.
Well, on that point, didn't Goldman Sachs have an advantage with computers working faster by 30 seconds or whatever it takes?
Yeah, there's this interesting stories now reading about how there's an arms race in finance, and it's to have the smartest people and the best technology. And it used to be that if you were in the days of telegraph, if you got information 4 or 5 minutes earlier, you could have an advantage. But now information moves so rapidly that the only way to have an advantage is to have it, you know, milliseconds. So they set up these giant computers. They get a peek of something and make a decision and do the buy before anybody can, any human being can actually see it. And that does kind of smell like knowing who's going to win the horse race and being able to put place a bet. And it looks like the SEC is going to regulate that. But it's a good example of what happened here. Finance changed so fast, and technology so much gave them so many new ways to do things, and the regulatory system was always slow to catch up. And in the case of the early 2000s, the gap between what was going on Wall Street and what the regulators were paying attention to and able to supervise was they were just falling way behind.
But, you know, once you have that kind of technology, how do you pull it back?
Well, all you can do is you can make rules, and then if you catch people cheating, yeah, you can discipline them. But it's important that now there's no rule against them doing this flash trading, apparently.
So cheating has been part of what's moved the economy forward?
People in finance are always looking for a way to find a little end run around a rule in order to get an advantage. And then we, as a society, have to decide whether we think the rules should be changed. And it's kind of a game of catch-up. And I think we're seeing the rules catching up to something. And I'm proud that the press exposed that.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And now to Amherst, Massachusetts. Good morning, Walter. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, good morning, Diane. Thank you very much for taking my phone call.
Certainly.
I teach mathematical principles of financial markets, and I taught it in the spring semester of 2008, just when Bear Stearns was blowing up. And I like to think, by the way, it was a junior-senior level course, and I like to think that if every regulator had taken my course, we wouldn't have had the problems that we now face. For example, one of the leitmotifs of this course, which is junior-senior level, is risk, value at risk, which is just techno-speak for how bad can it get, interest rate risk measured by duration of a bond, the modern portfolio theory where you plot the expected return of an asset versus its risk,
sure,
measured, and so on. So one thing that comes, there's a disturbing discrepancy between the mathematical predictions of the theory and what actually happens with, let's say, Renaissance Technologies and Goldman Sachs, which Mr. Wessels just commented on. The point is, it is impossible to get the results that Goldman Sachs and Renaissance Technologies get quarter after quarter, year after year, getting outsized returns without taking on enormous leverage or getting insider information. And I've often been worried or disturbed by not being able to understand how they do it. Now, this high-frequency trading seems to provide the answer. It is, in fact, some kind of cheating.
Do you believe that?
I think it's a really interesting question. I mean, my first reaction was going to be there were a lot of people on Wall Street that probably could have benefited from this course because they were taking lots of risk and they apparently didn't realize how much risk they were taking. And I'm talking about the CEO of Citigroup, the CEO of Merrill Lynch, the CEO of Bear Stearns, the CEO of Lehman Brothers. There are firms that seem to do a better job of managing risk, and they have managed to withstand the crisis better. The caller's absolutely right that if you borrow a lot of money when times are good, you can make outsized returns, and there was a lot of leverage. So then the real fundamental question, and the most disturbing one, is Goldman Sachs just better at the game, or are they cheating? And I honestly don't know if they're cheating, and I think that's something that the press and the regulators and everybody needs to watch carefully. And as he points out, as you pointed out, this flash trading has the kind of smell of cheating, of basically taking advantage of access to information that you have before other people's do. But I think we really have to be careful before we assume that because they do a good job at JPMorgan Chase or Goldman Sachs that they're cheating. It may be that they're just smarter.
One last quick question from Stan, a local small business owner. How does the economy recover when people are losing jobs at the same time?
You can't. The only way we get out of this is if we can export enough stuff and businesses start investing so that they can keep they can increase their hiring and consumers have spending. Right now, the government is picking up the slack, but that can't go on forever.
David Wessel, he's economics editor for The Wall Street Journal. His new book, really important reading for all of us, is titled In Fed We Trust, Ben Bernanke's War on the Great Panic. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. From the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And from the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Good morning. A Prairie Home Companion is coming up next on WAMU 88.5.
This is WAMU 88.5's Community Minute. I'm News Director Jim Ascendio.
And I'm General Manager Karen Mathis.
According to U.S. Census Bureau data, approximately 630,000 people in the D.C. area are at risk of or are experiencing hunger. 200,000 of them are children.
The Capital Area Food Bank distributed almost 20